On today's episode of the Productivity Podcast, I talk to Chris Bailey all about a life of productivity.
Welcome to the Productivity Show, the show that gets you where you want to be fast. Smash your goals and achieve more with actionable, easy-to-follow advice and become a Jedi Master of Productivity. And now, introducing your host, Paul Miners.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Productivity Podcast. It is a pleasure to have you listening to this episode. I really do mean that. I appreciate your time and your attention. And today's episode, I'm really glad you're listening because this is an awesome episode, an awesome interview with Chris Bailey from alifeofproductivity.com. And Chris is a really cool guy in the productivity space. He's actually one of the kind of real motivators that helped me to get started blogging about productivity. I saw his site and it really stands out from all of the kind of spammy listicle style posts that we typically see online related to productivity. His content is fantastic. He is a productivity scientist in a way. He experiments a lot on himself and tries different, testing different productivity methods and different weird and wacky experiments like living in isolation for 10 days, meditating for 40 hours a week, and all sorts of crazy experiments. And so his content's really good. I had a pleasure talking to Chris and discussing his new book as well, which is The Productivity Project. It's just come out and it's definitely worth picking up. So we dive into that as well. For the show notes for this episode, you can find them at paulminers.com/20. That's the 20th episode we're up to. Yes, another little milestone. So that's always good. And without further ado, thank you very much again for listening. Without further ado, this is episode number 20, an interview with Chris Bailey. Thanks. Enjoy. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the Productivity Podcast. Today, I am joined by Chris Bailey from alifeofproductivity.com. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, buddy, how's it going?
Yeah, really good. Really good. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. It is really great to have you on the show. Chris and I were talking just before we started, and I was saying, Chris, for those who don't know, and his website, A Life of Productivity, was, I've been following his work for a few years, very much since he'd started a year of productivity, his first website, and it was watching him and the content that he produces was very much a catalyst and a motivator behind me getting started. So Chris, just thank you, first of all, for everything that you've done and that you do. Because your stuff is awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much, man. You're pretty great too. Would you be able to remind folks, or maybe let folks know who are listening right now, what time it is where you are right now?
Yeah, good question. So it is 17 minutes past 5 in the morning.
Oh, here my God. Oh, my God. If I had to wake up at that hour, you are dedicated to the craft. So thank you. Thank you.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Well, like I was saying before, I'm up at this time anyway. So I'm an early riser. And it was no problems. So hey, why don't we start with a bit of the cliche intro? Why don't we start with an intro to yourself? And if you could just tell everyone sort of who you are and how you got started into the productivity space, because it is a great story, how you got started. I wonder if we could just start with that and dive into it.
Yeah, for sure. It started in May of 2013. When I graduated university, I graduated, I'd been productive up to that point. So I ended up graduating with a couple of full-time job offers. But I decided, if there's a time when I should follow my passion, it was then, after I graduated, between that space of going to school and working. And so I ended up declining those two full-time job offers to experiment with my deepest curiosity, which, it isn't cooking or sports or the news like normal sane people. It's productivity, like you, like so many of the people out there. And so that's when A Year of Productivity was born. I figured, the idea of a year-long project was a bit cliche when I graduated, but I looked at the bank account and I saw that I had about $12,000 Canadian, which is, the exchange rate is tumbling with the Canadian dollar, so it's less and less these days. But I figured, that's enough money if I ate a lot of beans and rice and cans of tuna for an entire year. To be able to follow this curiosity of mine for a year. And so for 1 year, I read all the books and academic literature that I could on human performance, especially in a workplace type environment. I interviewed the biggest gurus out there, the people that I'd respected for years, frankly, in the space. And I also conducted these productivity experiments on myself where I used myself as a guinea pig to explore what it means to become more productive. Usually from kind of the outside in, like a lot of them were a bit crazy. Like, you know, I gained 10 pounds of lean muscle mass. I worked 90-hour weeks for a month. I meditated for 35 hours over the course of the week. You know, we were talking about meditation before we started, and you know, I'm a big proponent of that, especially after that experiment. I tried waking up at 5:30 every morning and I did that for 3 months until I realized that I absolutely hated it. Unlike yourself, I drank only water for a month. So, you know, I conducted dozens of these productivity experiments and to see what worked with productivity and what didn't, and really tried to get to the bottom of what it takes to get more done every single day. And that led to, and I promise I'm done with this little introduction soon. That led to The Productivity Project, which is the book that's out now, which is kind of the crescendo for this year of experimenting with productivity.
That's so good. And as I was saying before, yeah, I haven't read the book yet, but for everyone listening, I do have a little, I think it's an introduction from the book to give away, which we'll have details of later. And having just read that, I cannot wait to read the full book. And being familiar with the content on your site, I'm sure it's going to be top quality. So I really can't wait to pick it up. But
it's actually terrible. It's a terrible book. I don't know why you're having me on.
I'm sure that's not true.
No, we're really fortunate. The reviews that are coming in have been really, really good. You know, I'm always kind of shy about pimping my own stuff, but this is something I'm really proud of.
That's good. You should be, and I definitely know the feeling. You know, when you don't want to like blow your own trumpet, so to speak. But
if I could blow my own trumpet, I would never leave my apartment.
No, it's good to hear that the reviews are coming in so positive, and I'm not surprised. And you know, as you were mentioning before, all these experiments, that's definitely one of the things that I find has made you just stand out over the years, because as I'm sure you're aware and people listening, there's so much noise out there now in the productivity space. I find there's so many of these like 10 tips to get more done and five ways to keep on top of your inbox, and it's all just recycled start of content. And you've got this great angle where you're actually, you know, conducting these experiments on yourself, you know, and you're documenting and really interesting experiments, and you're documenting the experience and sharing it. I wondered if we could talk about all that. Like, with all the experiments that you've done, was there one that really stood out as being like one of the biggest influences on your productivity?
I think it might have been living in isolation for 10 days. And yeah, on the other point, I totally agree. You know, all these kind of hacky articles and stuff like that. Becoming more productive is hard. And if you could reduce what it takes to get more done to a list of 10 tactics, you know, there wouldn't be a reason for the productivity sphere to exist. But I think a lot of people like to look for these simple answers. But really, like, the thing about productivity tactics is the time you spend reading about them, you have to make that time back and then some for that time to be worthwhile. And most of them don't do that. And that's something I discovered in the project, is that, you know, there's so much advice out there, but so much of it is BS. You know, this book that I put out is 304 pages. But, you know, there's an equal, maybe double-sized book, maybe 608 pages of stuff that didn't work, of stuff that simply, you know, is treading water. Because, you know, frankly, for every minute you spend investing in your productivity, you know, that's 1 minute you not only have to make back, but that's 1 minute that you're not working on the work that you're planning or, you know, kind of treading water on. And so it is important to kind of take that step back, but I think to a certain point. But anyway, to your question, the experiment that kind of struck me the hardest was living in isolation for 10 days. And so for 10 days, I cut myself off from people, from social interaction, and from sunlight. I put up a blanket in the place we were living at the time, where the basement was, so nobody could kind of see me and I couldn't see them. And I lived down there. I stocked up on perishable food. You know, made sure there was enough water. I made sure I had everything that I needed to sustain myself for 10 days. And I lived down there and noticed how that impacted my productivity when I was cut off from people in the outside world. And you know, something kind of curious happens when you, I think when you step back from these different elements of your life, and the people are included, and you see this, you know, at New Year's, you know, when you take a step back from your work and from your life, you kind of create the attentional space for you to create goals for the future. And the same is true when you take a vacation and you take a step back and you see all the things you want to do differently. And that was really the case for people and productivity. And it taught me how, you know, just how crucial people are to your productivity, not just in motivating you to get more done, but, you know, that people are the reason that we're productive in the first place. You know, let's say the apocalypse happens tomorrow, and, you know, you wake up tomorrow morning and you're the only person left on the planet. It wouldn't matter how productive you were if you were the only person on the planet. Productivity is very much an idea that exists for the benefit of people beyond yourself, I think.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, because I know that I'm the kind of person, I definitely appreciate those moments during the day when you could find some time to be alone and work on whatever you're working on. So that's one of the reasons I enjoy getting up early, is there are no distractions, there's no one around to bother me. And likewise with work, I often come home early in the day. I'm fortunate where I can come home and do some focused work in the afternoon by myself and have those moments of isolation. But I there's a barrier there. There's a tipping point there, right? Like too much, as you said, is like, it's going to be very detrimental, because you don't have those people like checking in and holding you accountable, and yeah, you just sort of lack that motivation.
Yeah, and for the first couple of days, it was incredible. You know, it's like, oh, there's no people around. You know, I can do whatever I want. But there's an African proverb that I love, and I'm going to butcher it now for you and your audience, where if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And I think that's the case with productivity and with anything, really. You know, it's nothing without the people.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah,
I didn't butcher that, by the way. I think I got it spot on. I'm patting myself on my back right now.
No, that's a really nice little proverb. I haven't heard that before, but it's an interesting one, yeah. Because we do hear a lot of time in these kind of spammy articles that other people can be one of the biggest like detriments to your productivity. And so I guess like one of the takeaways I'm hearing is just like people should experiment with it themselves, you know. And I love the use of the word experiment, like and it kind of highlights, I suppose, one of the biggest points I find in productivity, which you sort of encapsulate with your site, is that with all the advice that we hear, you should always take it with a grain of salt. Like what might work for you, Chris, might not work for me. Like I enjoy getting up early, but I know you're not a morning person. And so with everything that I tell people, I always say like, this is just what I do. Go and try it for yourself. Like conduct an experiment in your own life. See if it works. And if it does, cool. If it doesn't, sweet. You can move on and try something else. And so with the isolation stuff, if you enjoy working on your own and see how that impacts you. But yeah, like one of the biggest takeaways I've had from reading your stuff is just to use all these to take all these bits of advice and just use them as an opportunity to conduct your own mini experiments.
Oh, exactly. And everybody is so different when it comes to productivity. And I think that's why so much of, you know, the best productivity tactics, at least, have to do with better getting to know how you operate and how you work. And so take, you know, waking up early is a great example. The research around that shows that there's no difference in socioeconomic standing between somebody who wakes up early and somebody who wakes up later. It's very much, you know, what position you're in your life. Like if you have a family, or if you have these quiet hours in the wee hours of the morning where you can get this focused work done, you know, chances are waking up early will make you more productive. But, and everybody's programmed differently too. So if you naturally bring more energy to whatever's in front of you in the morning, you're going to accomplish more in that time than somebody who naturally has more energy late at night. You know, we have these different rhythms that we have over the course of the day, and everybody's wired differently. You know, I'm a night owl. You're a morning person. I was up until 1 a.m. last night just reading books, you know, because that's often what I do. I get kind of lost in a lot of the literature out there. And so, you know, we probably both woke up about an hour before we chatted, but it's 5 a.m. where you are, and it's 11 a.m. where I am. And so it really does depend on the person and the situations that they're in. And, you know, waking up early is just one of the examples out there. And you, the thing is, though, you see all these articles about how waking up early is the key to productivity, but the research just doesn't back that up. You know, it backs it up that that situation might exist for some people, but it wouldn't exist for everyone just because everybody's wired so differently.
Yeah, totally. Completely agree. And actually, you know, it's funny going back to the these spammy articles we keep referencing.
We keep
it's
hammering funny. On. Yeah.
I did a little experiment of my own recently because I saw I was like, okay, let's try one of these articles just to see how that affects like traffic to the site and things. So I wrote recently this article, 50 hacks for planning, organizing, and getting more done, and it was just a big old list. And I wanted to do a big list, of just like tips and tricks that I just compiled into one place, and damn it, it did really well. And it's interesting, like these spammy articles, people just really lap them up. So I don't know, that was my own little experiment recently. It worked really well, but like everything in there as well, I just say, like, you know, with each of these tips, this is not like a golden rule. Go and take it, try it, and see if it works. But that was a weird little result for me.
I found that too, you know. I did that. I don't like to put together too many lists, and I've tried to kind of avoid that approach lately, but occasionally I do, you know. Whenever I put a list of 10 things together, it's very much like a 5,000 word article that I boil down to happen to be 1 or 2,000 words. That just, this format seems to resonate with folks, because, you know, people only have so much time, and if they can skim and dive into the points that they want, you know, all the more power to them. But I tried that experiment too, where I had an article that I'd published when I first started the project, and, you know, it got maybe a couple thousand hits, and then I republished that article as kind of one of these I don't know how you want to say it, like kind of junk food type headlines, where it's just kind of surface level and really flashy and attractive, and it got, you know, tens of thousands of hits. So it's incredible how it was the exact same article, but it was just framed differently. I truly have no idea. This was several months back.
Okay.
but I can go and try to dig it up.
That's all good. No, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah, that's just by putting a different spin on it. And I think you're right. Like, people's with social media and technology, our habits are changing, and I think people's attention spans are getting shorter. I know, you know, just thinking about my own experiences, like, I can definitely vouch for that. And I try and kind of keep myself honest, and like, if I am spending time looking at Twitter, I do try and, like, you know, genuinely read stuff. And if I am clicking on an article, don't just read the headlines. If you want to spend the time, or if you've spent the time to click on it, have a good read. Like,
Enjoy yourself. Like, stay a while.
Yeah.
Take your coat off.
Exactly. And being like a content creator myself, like, I know how hard probably someone has worked to create that, and how much good stuff is hopefully going to be in there. So I definitely know that I've been guilty of, like, you skim through stuff and it's like, oh, is this interesting? Like, quickly open it, have a quick look, oh, move on. Like, so I think I try and remain honest with that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, yesterday I did something that I hadn't done in a while, and I left my phone at home. I just carried around a little notepad with me, and I brought, you know, 3 or 4 books to a coffee shop and sat there for 5 or 6 hours just reading. And, you know, it was such, because I hadn't been disconnected for that amount of time in a long time. You know, occasionally throughout the day, I go 1 or 2 hours without the internet in little pieces here and there. But there's always kind of a part of me in the back of my head that's kind of clamoring for the internet again, because it's so stimulating, right? Staying connected and constantly, you know, plugged into these series of distractions and interruptions. It's a more engaging and stimulating way of working, but you really just skim the surface. And I was able to blow through, you know, hundreds of pages. I finished a book yesterday night too, just diving deep into these things. And it's amazing not only how much time we waste and how much attention we waste, but how much productivity we waste when we're constantly connected because we don't have this richness of experience. You know, life is richer without the internet. And that's one of the things I found with the experiment to use my smartphone for an hour a day for 3 months. And so, you know, before that experiment, my smartphone was attached at my hip. But when I was doing it, and I forced myself to deliberately disconnect more frequently, eventually I kind of cleared a bend. And it was like a whole new expanse of focus opened up for me. And I was able to bring so much more of myself to whatever work was in front of me. And, you know, that doesn't work all the time. And we do need to stay connected quite frequently. But at the same time, I think we kind of trick ourselves into thinking that we always have to be connected.
Yeah.
When there is this these huge productivity benefits to not being. You know, one of my favorite studies, it was conducted by Tim Pitchell from Carleton University in Ottawa. I'm in Ottawa too, so I've had a chance to get a coffee with this guy a couple times. He's a really nice guy. He's found that of the time we spend on the internet, we spend 47% of that time procrastinating on what we intend to accomplish. And you see this in daily practice. You know, you go to the internet with the best of intentions, just wanting to check out one website, and then you're sucked into this rabbit hole of, you know, of productivity, and you know, you end up on somebody's 13th Facebook profile that you used to know back in high school. And it's like, how the hell did I get here? Where you lose grip of that intention. Yeah. Of what you originally intended to do. That's why I think disconnecting can be so powerful, is, you know, you get this attention back, you get that time back, and you get that richness of experience back, and you get that focus back, in that, you know, you don't waste half of your attention and time procrastinating.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the study. What was it, 47%, did you say, of time is spent procrastinating?
Yeah, he measured how students, you know, he's a researcher at a university, so they typically measure students. He measured how, yeah, they spent their time when they were connected to the internet. And that study was conducted before the advent of social media, so before Twitter and Facebook and all these things became popular. And, you know, just for kicks sometimes, you know, I kind of like going back to where I used to go to college and all that stuff to kind of walk through the campus and see the way thing where I used to be, because it's a cool environment, it's a fun environment, it's fresh, you know, when I'm working from home all the time. But occasionally, when I really want to hunker down on an article, I like to go to the library, and it's open to the public, of course, at my university. And I have this little desk that I go to in the library, and there's a row of computers, kind of these little cubbies that you can walk by as you go to the bathroom or look for a book or something. And when I walk by these people, pretty much every single one of them is on Facebook, they're on Twitter, they're watching something on Netflix, and this is the prime exam time. And so I would definitely argue that it's above 50% now, just how much time people waste, where they wouldn't waste that time if they were disconnected.
That's incredible. And I was thinking before about a talk that, or a video that I saw by Scott Hanselman, and I think he gave a talk in New Zealand, actually. I think it's an older video, but he referenced this study that was done with like lab rats, and how they had these lab rats, and there were two levers in their cage. One of them would give him a shock. I can't remember what the point of the study was. One of them would give it a shock, and the other lever would deliver like a treat. And the rat eventually learned which lever was associated with reward. And so he would just pull this lever to get the treat, pull it to get a treat, pull it to get a treat. And he then, the talk was done so well, he just slid this like image of a Facebook thread onto the thing. And you just pull to refresh, and it was like this tool to get the instant like stimulation. You yeah. used the word before, like, and it was just so interesting. This like study, and it's true. Like, we do have this ability to just pull these different levers and distract ourselves in so many different ways. It's incredible, and it is very easy to just, as you're working, quickly like Command T and open a new tab and quickly check what's going on, and then without even realizing you've wasted a ton of time. It's dangerous out there.
and there are different types of stimulus that kind of condition us. And I think what that talk was about, I haven't seen the talk, but I'm assuming what it was about was the most addictive type of stimulus is when we are stimulating at non-random intervals or at random intervals. And so, you know, if we're a mouse and we know we're getting a treat every hour, you know, our anticipation of that treat goes up towards the end of the hour and yeah. goes down at the beginning of it. But if it's random, you know, we'll keep clicking that lever because we don't know when the treat is going to come. And, yeah. and the same is true with email. We don't get one email every hour. We get emails at random intervals every single hour, which causes us to refresh all the time. And the same is true with Twitter, with social media, which makes us, which creates the conditions for it to be optimally addictive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find one of the solutions to overcoming this, and Chris, if you've got anything else that you recommend, please let us know. But one of the tools that I've used in the past is Rescue Time, which I'm sure many people will have heard of. And this app that you install, it sits in the background on your computer and it tracks which applications you use, which websites you browse to. And when you set it up, you can specify what kind of websites are distracting.
So it doesn't track the you can set it so it doesn't track the naughty websites too.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
yeah.
that I know from experience, though. I definitely don't know from experience.
And but the awareness that it gives you, I think, is really powerful, because you can see at the end of the day, like, this is exactly how long you spent on Facebook or how long you spent on Twitter or whatever else, and reading different articles. And I think that's a really powerful tool for just once you have that awareness. It's similar to the Fitbit, I find, when yeah. I got the Fitbit. You know, just having the awareness of how many steps you do can prompt you to take action when you've had a bit of a lazy day. You definitely know that awareness just motivates you to go out and do something. So for yeah. anyone who finds themselves getting distracted easily, like, definitely check out Rescue Time. And Chris, if you have any other recommendations.
I love Rescue Time. I use it all the time. The only downside to it is that it tracks how much time you spend on something like Twitter or email, but it doesn't necessarily track how much attention you spend on it. And so, you know, you could spend 10 minutes on email over the course of an hour, and, you know, that's a sixth of the hour. And if you spend the other 5/6 of the hour, the other 50 minutes on something productive, you look on the surface to be pretty productive. But when you kind of switch back and forth between, you know, work yeah. that's important and checking your email, so that accumulates to the 10 minutes, you know, that costs you a disproportionate amount of attention than it does time, which can, you know, which causes you or prevents you from diving deep, deep, deep into the work. And what I found, you know, it has a pro mode. They have a pro mode where they have this mode called Get Focused, where, you know, you can set up an amount of time, and it blocks how... it blocks all these distracting apps and websites and everything for the time that you specify. And this is hugely powerful. And I use this all the time because I struggle with this stuff too. And, you know, for that reason, you know, that feature is one of my favorites.
Yeah, and you mentioned like attention before, and you know, it makes me think about like task switching, and every time you switch between something, even if it's just a small little thing, you know, quickly switching to check something, you have to spend a little bit of your attention switching to that task, and then when you're returning to your work, you have to spend attention, and there's that little bit of decision fatigue coming in there as well, as you have to remind yourself, what was I working on, where was I, and there's a cost in heard every time you switch. And so, yeah, if you can try and kind of focus on one thing for longer and reduce the amount of switches you make, I think that can have a big impact in terms of like maintaining that focus and keeping
yeah.
productive.
And focus time is good for that because it blocks the bad stuff, and you can still visit the good stuff. And I think it costs something like $10 a month, but and a lot of people balk at that price, but it's like, what's your time worth? And what's your productivity worth? Like if that $10 allows you to buy back 10 hours over the course of
totally,
a week of
yeah.
productivity, like, is your time really not worth a dollar an hour? Like, come on.
Yeah. It's a no-brainer, right? And I'm putting it like that. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, great recommendation. Going back to the experiments that we were discussing before. Do you have like a, like, what is the weirdest thing that you did maybe to try and boost your productivity that you were surprised, like, had a really good result? Like, was there anything like that? Like, really shocking, surprising results from really weird experiments? Anything like that?
I think meditation, you know, meditating for 35 hours over the course of a week. And I did this at the point in my project where, you know, I kind of saw meditation and productivity as opposites. And so I saw, you know, productivity as a way of doing more and more and more, faster, faster, faster. And meditation is doing, you know, basically nothing, as slow as possible. You know, what could be less productive than that? But the experiment kind of taught me how important focus is in the work that we do. So let's say the two of us are working on a report, and you know, you're amazing at focusing, and so you bring 80% of your attention to what's in front of you. But I suck at focusing. I'm constantly distracted. I can't manage my attention. I'm interrupted all the time. I don't shut off alerts or anything. And so I bring 40% of my attention to the work that's in front of me. In the same amount of time, you know, for every minute, you're going to accomplish, I think, at least twice as much than I am, because you're going to bring that much more of yourself to your work. And what I found in this experiment is that, you know, productivity, you know, time is important, but attention and how much energy as well we bring to our work is often just as important as how much time we spend on it. And I think it's so easy to overlook that fact, but attention is one of the most underrated ideas when it comes to productivity. And meditation is a way of building up how much attention you bring to what's in front of you. And I really think, especially after that experiment, that for every minute that you meditate, you gain that time back and then some in terms of how much additional focus you bring to your work.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I started with meditation a few years ago with the Headspace app. And I really enjoy it. And I try and include some meditation in my morning routine for at least 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I know that when I do, and when I when I do make the time to sit down and make it happen, you definitely feel the impact it has on your day. And I feel like, for me, how do I put it into words? Like, you just feel less rushed and less busy in your mind.
Yeah.
And I just feel like there's the fog kind of clears a little bit when after you meditate. And I wanted to ask, though, what is your approach? Do you use any apps? Do you go completely unguided? And part B to that question, to help me, is what kind of tips do you have for making it a consistent part of your routine?
Yeah, for sure. I meditate for about half an hour each day, and I don't do guided meditations, but I've been meditating for, you know, I sound like I'm bragging, but I've been meditating for quite some time. I've been to a lot of meditation retreats and stuff like that, so I have the practice that's, you know, got me to that point. I definitely started with the guided meditations and reading all the books. Mindfulness in Plain English is one of the best books that I've encountered. And I think you can read it for free online. I don't know where you would find that, but you know, you can just visit a website, like the website for the book, and you can read the entire book there. It's an incredible resource to getting started. I do about half an hour of Vipassana meditation a day, just kind of mindfully observing my breath. And, you know, I find that, you know, not every day I want to do it, but every day I do it, simply because I've realized over time that the less I want to do it, the more I actually need it. And there's a quote where, you know, it says, like, on a regular day, you should meditate for half an hour. But if you're really, really busy, you should meditate for an hour. I think that quote is kind of BS, because, like, every part of you doesn't want to meditate for an hour when you have so much work to do. You know, there's every part of you resists the ritual. But I found that the less I want to do it, the more I need it. And so the more I need to stick with it on those days. Not necessarily that I need to do more, but that I need to kind of keep up with the ritual then. Especially as things kind of get stressful and hectic. Like these days, I'm doing so many interviews around the launch of this book. And if I didn't meditate for half an hour each day, I would probably go insane. Because switching the modes, you know, you kind of live inside your head for a year as you write a book, and then you live outside in the world, especially when you have people that are kind of promoting the book with you. You kind of have to flip modes and, you know, live, you know, go on TV shows and podcasts and radio shows and interviews and of all shapes and sizes. It's an interesting mode to flip, and I think I would go slightly insane and burn out a little bit if it weren't for meditation. And so that's what I do each day, and I do it different times each day. Sometimes I split it up into 15-minute chunks. Sometimes I do it in the middle of the day as kind of a workday break. Sometimes I do it at night. You know, it really does depend on when I wake up and what I have to accomplish that day. But a couple methods that I found helpful for sticking with it is to shrink your resistance to the habit. And so, you know, on days that I really don't feel like meditating, I'll say to myself, okay, do I want to meditate for half an hour today? Like, okay, no, the thought of it puts me off. Okay, what about 20 minutes? You know, it's getting a bit better, but then, okay, what about 15 minutes? You know, I can meditate for 15 minutes. And then I meditate for 15 minutes. And I find that at the end of those 15 minutes, because I've settled into that rhythm and I got over that initial resistance, I can keep going for the rest of the 15 minutes like I usually do. And so finding the resistance that you have to the ritual. And there are some days when you feel like you don't have time for certain things. And I find that that's especially the case with tasks that are aversive, tasks that, you know, your brain just fights off. And, you know, meditation, your brain fights it off more than anything else. That's kind of the point of meditation. But I think framing it differently, where you kind of perform a swap, and I've been playing around with this idea a little bit lately, where I'll say to myself, okay, Do I want to meditate for half an hour? And then I tell myself, no, I don't. But then I ask myself like something really attractive, like, you know, okay, could I take a half an hour break right now to watch the Colbert Show or whatever it might be? And I'll say, yeah, you know, I could probably manage that. And then I say, okay, I'm not going to watch Colbert. I'm going to meditate instead, because yeah. I see that I actually have that amount of time. And I find that that's always the case.
That's really interesting, and a couple of things stood out there for me. Like, so firstly, you sometimes break up your meditation. So even doing 15 minutes at lunch and 15 later in the day is a really interesting approach. There's no reason to say you have to do it all at once. I thought that was really interesting. And secondly, the other thing that stood out was a further question is, I wonder if for me, I aim for 10 minutes, which is, yeah, sounds like nothing compared to what you're doing. But do you think is that enough time to get into it? Or do you think for that amount of time, like, you know, if I just went a bit longer, would I reach like a tipping point where I then really get into it and really feel some benefits and going for longer becomes a lot easier? Does such tipping point exist?
The answer is, I don't know. the neuroscience that I've encountered around meditation, it seems to find that at least 5 minutes a day is enough to have these neurological benefits. And that the more you meditate beyond that point, the deeper and the greater the benefits will be. But, you know, 10 minutes a day is incredible, especially if you do it every day. You know, it's an incredible habit. And, you know, the worst thing you could possibly do is say, okay, instead of 10 minutes, I'm going to meditate for half an hour every single day. And then, you know, kind of give up halfway through. And I've fallen into that trap before as well. So it's not kind of blind advice. I would suggest kind of playing around with it and seeing how differently you feel. And this goes back to the idea of experimentation when it comes to productivity. You know, maybe you'll notice that, you know, you accomplish more when you meditate for longer, or maybe you won't really feel many benefits at all. And I think it really does depend on the person and how busy you are and how calm you are on a, you know, regularly. But I think 10 minutes is great. And if you can do more, then that's great. But I think 10 minutes is good starting point.
Okay. I mean, maybe what I might try doing is trying a couple of longer stints, like 15 or 20 minutes, and then try a couple of 10-minute sessions throughout the day. Like maybe like a 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at lunch, even 10 in the afternoon or evening, and see how different routines impact me. Yeah, I think that's, and as you said, yeah, it all comes back to experimentation and finding what works for you.
Yeah, and so much of it is taking that step back just to sharpen how much focus you bring to your work. And that's why meditation is so powerful. Like there's that Abe Lincoln quote where he said, you know, give me 6 hours to chop down a tree and I'll spend the first four sharpening the axe. And meditation, you know, first of all, I wouldn't sharpen the axe for 4 hours. That's a bit ridiculous. But you know, meditation is a way of sharpening that axe throughout the day. It also lets you recharge. So I think, you know, a periodic break throughout the day, as well as that 10-minute ritual in the morning or whenever it is that you do it, I think that could be really beneficial.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, as a team where I work, we do take the whole group of us, we do take a walk early, at about, it must be 10:30 every day. And definitely like, cause we do a big stint before that and then we come back completely refreshed afterwards. So, you know, even if meditation isn't your thing, if you can just find some time during the day to just take these mini breaks to just refocus and recharge, I think it can be incredibly, incredibly beneficial.
Yeah. And on the taking breaks point, you know, the science says that we have a limited pool of physiological energy in our brain. And once we run out of that, our brain kind of shuts off. That's why when you work through tiredness and fatigue, like it or not, if you don't take a break, your brain will take a break for you. And so taking these breaks throughout the day, you know, one of the things I really try to pimp in the book is taking these frequent rapid breaks like throughout the day. I would even suggest every hour, just so you have that time to recharge, because, you know, our work is a lot different than it used to be, right? Because we used to work in factories. We used to do this repetitive assembly line type work where it took a lot of time. You know, it took not from 9 to 5, but it didn't take much focus or energy or attention. But the work today, you know, it's like the 40% to 80% example of the focus. You know, it benefits from all the focus we can possibly bring to it and also all the energy we could possibly bring to it. And so I think, you know, it seems counterintuitive, right? Because for every minute you spend working out or eating well or exercising or meditating or getting enough sleep, you know, that's a minute or an hour that you don't spend doing work and feeling productive. But when productivity isn't just how you spend your time, but it's also how you spend your attention and energy, you know, it's so important that you do.
Yeah, completely agree. And it is one of those very overlooked things, isn't it? When we talk about productivity, people just naturally think about time and time management and how they're spending their time without necessarily putting much thought into how they spend their energy and how they spend their attention. Because those, they're all different kind of forms of currency, which we need to fuel our productivity. And it is, you do need to think about those and how each one contributes to the other. I find, yeah, no. Moving on to the book, so The Productivity Project. I wonder if you could talk us through the inspiration behind the book. I know that you mentioned earlier, it's kind of the kind of summary, I suppose, to your experiences with a life of productivity. What is the main like problem that you're hoping to solve with the book, and who do you think it's like best suited to?
My intention is to kind of help everybody with this book, and so you can kind of look at the cover and see, like, you know, it's not just the productivity nerds like ourselves that would be into this type of thing. And my focus with the book is to, you know, take everything out there, you know, take all the research, all the books, all the academic literature, all the interviews, all the expert stuff, all the experiments, and boil it down to the stuff that actually works, not just for me, but for everybody. And that's how the book is structured. You know, I tried to make it entertaining at the same time. So there's stories from the experiments. I didn't just copy and paste stuff from my blog in case you were worried about that. but there's, you know, stories from the experiments. There's all of these golden nuggets that I discovered over the course of the project, kind of boiled down of the hundreds of things that I play it around with. You know, I picked 25 that I think will actually help folks out the most on a daily basis.
So are these things then, because we've talked before about how some stuff works for others and not other people, are these things that you, these 25 topics that you're discussing in the book, are these things that are pretty concrete? Like if you do them, they are highly likely to work? Are they almost like kind of golden rules? Am I right in assuming that?
I think so, yeah. And not every single one will work for everybody, but I think, you know, 90% of them will work for most people. 90% work for most people. I sound like I'm hedging my bets. I think 90% of them will work for anybody. And, you know, you're right in that everybody is different, but I find that a lot of these things are universal. Let's say the rule of three as an example. You know, it's such a simple tactic. It's so easy. You know, the rule of three is, you know, at the start of each day, you step back and you think, by the time the day is done, what three things will I want to have accomplished? And you know, it's such a simple rule. It's almost stupidly simple. But the idea is that it allows you to step back, think about what's important, and work more deliberately and with more intention on those things over the course of the day. You know, it lets you consider your constraints. It lets you think about what you don't want to accomplish at the same time. And so a tactic like that, I think, can work for everybody. You know, a tactic like working when you have the most energy, you know, part of that is getting to understand yourself, you know, having this self-knowledge of how much energy you have in different hours of the day. But I think, you know, kind of taking that step back, seeing where you stand and going from there, that's kind of a basis for so many of the tactics. But so many of them are also universal, like the rule of three.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely going to be bits of advice out there that are like pretty much guaranteed things to work, right? I mean, like as a silly example, if you've got a project due, don't spend time on Facebook. Like it's going to be pretty universal for everyone.
And I think the productivity tactics that aren't universal aren't worth writing about. You know, like waking up early will be, you know, the key to your productivity. If that doesn't work universally, I don't think it's worth writing about, because it just isn't true for everybody.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point, actually. That is really interesting. And actually, one of the things I believe you mentioned in the book is the importance of like slowing down and eliminating everything that's unimportant. And I wondered if you could comment on this, because this is something I've actively changed in how I work recently after reading Essentialism, which was a fantastic book. And so I've definitely relooked at the different things I'm working on and how I spend my energy and attention. And even like the example, for those who haven't read the book, the example that Greg gives in the book is about cleaning out your wardrobe. So generally with most of us, you know, we buy clothes and we fill up our wardrobe without really purging the stuff that we no longer wear. And so he says, like, as an exercise, like, just look at your wardrobe and take out stuff that you no longer wear, that you definitely don't wear. Take it and then find a pile of things that you think you're going to wear, and then throw that away as well, because you're not going to wear them. And you're left with the stuff that you know you're going to wear, and the couple of shirts or pants that you really like, that you really want to hang on to. And I actually did the exercise after reading the book, where I purged my wardrobe, just as a little commitment to myself that I'm going to take this first step, and then I'm going to do the same with the rest of my life. And it was incredibly liberating. So just starting with the wardrobe, and like, I literally threw away probably 2/3 of my clothes, and I'm left with some t-shirts and shirts and a couple of pants. And the liberating feeling that comes from eliminating the non-essentials was incredible. And then when you start to apply that to your life, I've definitely noticed like a decrease in kind of urgency and stress that can come about when you have too many things on the go. I wonder if, Chris, you could comment on your own experience with the importance of slowing down and, you know, eliminating some of these non-essentials.
It's funny how little is important in the work that we do. And this is what I found from the coaching that I've done in the past, the speaking that I do, is that the average person, it's not like they have 10 tasks in their work or 10 projects in their work that are important. They usually have 3 tops that are important. And after that, you know, their productivity for every minute they invest in the tasks beyond that, you know, it falls off a cliff. And So there, when there's so little that's important, you know, every minute you spend on those tasks, you accomplish so much more than you do with the other tasks in your work or in your life. It's the same way. And so, you know, taking that step back to see what those tasks are, and everything else is usually a support task that can be eliminated, delegated, or shrunk. So for example, you can shrink how frequently you check email throughout the day. And this is something huge that everybody can do, because the simple fact that not all tasks in our work are created equal. You know, there are some that allow us to accomplish a disproportionate amount for every minute that we spend on them. It means that we have to become more deliberate about what we work on, not just in general, but also in the moment.
Yeah, and do you have any recommendations about steps that people can take to identify those important tasks?
Yeah, I'll go through kind of one of the exercises in the book. I recommend that everybody take a step back from your work and make a list of all the activities that you do over the course of a month. So check email, write blog posts, you know, Twitter, you know, all these different things. And when you have that list of all the activities that you're responsible for, pick the one that you find allows you to accomplish the most in the same amount of time as everything else. And that becomes the most important task, the most fruitful task in your work. And then take some time to think about what second task allows you to accomplish the most and what third task allows you to accomplish the most. And after that, after you find these tasks that allow you to produce the most value, and oftentimes you have to consult with your manager, with your team to figure out what these tasks are. After that, you'll probably find that the marginal return on your productivity falls off a cliff. And so just taking that time to step back and separate the signal from the noise, I think that's something huge that you can do.
Yeah, I agree. And the other thing I find has worked well for me since reading Essentialism was just starting with the basics, you know, thinking about where do you want to get to? And this doesn't necessarily have to correspond to your work day. You could be thinking about your personal life and any goals that you have or any side projects that you're working on. Just thinking about where do I want to get to with this project, and which of these tasks are going to make the biggest impact on me getting there? Yeah. So for me this year, to use one of my own examples, me this year, I want to grow the traffic and the revenue that I get from my website. That's one of the biggest goals that I have this year. It's really simple. Like that, I just want to have more people coming so I can help more people and hopefully grow the revenue from the toolkit that I sell. And so with every opportunity that comes my way, with every idea that I have, because some of my own ideas, you get really excited about them, but they aren't always good ideas, and the excitement kind of trumps, you get carried away. So I'm now testing myself and challenging myself with every opportunity, with every idea, with every task that I think I need to do, to just think, actually, is this going to get me towards that goal? And the answer might be yes, but there's going to be something else potentially that is going to get you there quicker or going to have a greater impact on me reaching that goal. And so I looked at my task list in Asana and I cut out a bunch of stuff that I thought was important, and now I'm focusing on far fewer things, to the point where I'm almost like reassessing, like, you know, are these things even the most important? Are there even more important things that I can spend my time on? And I know that in Essentialism as well, one of the big points is spending time in the beginning to make sure you're working on the right things and not just doing what you think you should be doing, but actually exploring all of your options. And that's what the Essentialist does, is they explore all of their options before committing to the one or two that really has an impact.
It's amazing how many people want to invest in their productivity without stepping back to think about what they actually want to become more productive on. And, you know, they take that exact wrong approach where, you know, they work faster and more frantically instead of, you know, taking that step back, sharpening their axe, first of all, you know, investing in their energy levels at the same time and working with more deliberateness and with intention. And above anything else, you know, I think from the Productivity Project, the biggest lesson that I got was that productivity isn't about doing more faster. It's about doing the right things deliberately and with more intention. And deliberateness, I think, kind of lies at the heart of productivity and what it means to be productive today.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. with that statement. And yeah, just support it one more time. Like, just taking the time to step back and reassess, like, what are you working on? Where do you want to be? Is time that you can only is only going to be well spent. Chris, as we come to the end here, I wanted to ask a couple of quick questions. We talked about some books before we started the chat.
Yeah.
Do you have any books that you're reading at the moment, or any good, any favorite productivity books that you recommend to people listening?
Oh my gosh. Books I'm reading right now. I usually have 5 or 6 books on the go. So it's not a good, it's not as good of a question as it might appear on the surface. books I'd recommend, you know, I think happiness is a curious idea when it comes to productivity, in that happiness allows us to see more positive and opportunities around us. And the studies bear this out. Sean Acor wrote a book called The Happiness Advantage, which I love. And he's found that happier people are 31% more productive than everyone else. And that's a good place to start, I think, is with the happiness advantage. Of course, with getting things done, you know, kind of the biggest book about productivity that's out there right now. That's another fantastic place to start. And one that I'll echo from earlier on in our chat is Mindfulness in Plain English, because I think mindfulness and productivity are more correlated than people might think. So yeah, those are three that I'd recommend checking out.
As well as your own book, of course.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I wasn't going to say it, but it's my book is kind of, you know, I looked at, okay, what are all the books that's out there, and what are the biggest lessons from all of them? And so it's kind of the one that stands on the shoulders of all the giants out there, but kind of summarizes them all.
Brilliant. And so for people interested in picking up the book, where can they go to do that?
It is in bookstores everywhere. I've always wanted to say that. And, you know, on Amazon sites everywhere, and anywhere books are sold, really.
Awesome. And check out alifeofproductivity.com, where Chris has details of the book, and he's linked out to the different bookstores that where you can pick it up as well. And Chris, so now that you're done with the book, or starting to wrap up with the book, I suppose you're busy with the launch still at the moment. What is next for you and your website? What do you see on the horizon kind of moving forward?
Yeah, one of the things I love doing these days is speaking about productivity in front of audiences. So I love getting up and getting excited in front of a group of people and helping them out in becoming more productive. So that's one of the things I'm going to focus on going forward, and, you know, hopefully have some time for writing in there too, and you know, focusing on the next book.
Awesome. I have seen,
sorry, there's some construction going on outside my building. I don't know if you heard that hammer. Did you hear that?
I did. Okay. I did, yeah.
Sorry about that.
Talking about productivity and the distractions, I imagine you'll go and spend another 5 hours in a book in a coffee shop reading after this.
Maybe, perhaps. I'm not sure. It's a possibility.
Now, awesome. Well, Chris, thank you one more time for coming onto the podcast. It was a pleasure to talk to you today. It's been awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Chris Bailey. I certainly had a great time chatting with him. As I said before, I'm a big fan of his work. So yeah, it was great to chat to Chris. And as I said before, the show notes for this show are at paulminers.com/20. And when you go there, you can pick up an introduction to Chris's book, The Productivity Project. Read the intro, check it out. If you like it, please go pick up a copy, support Chris and everything that he does. One more time, thank you very much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed the episode, I would really, 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 really appreciate an iTunes review. This isn't really something I've pushed before, but I'd love to get some reviews and feedback on the show. I do know that the reviews help with rankings in iTunes, and if you can help me to rise up the rankings just a little bit, I would be forever grateful. So thank you one more time for listening to this episode, and I will catch you next time on the Productivity Podcast.